Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Welcome to Beyond the Game. My name is Gregan, and today I'm talking with Joe Bernard, one half of Omnipope.
Well, the very first thing I did was a box opening. Mm-hmm. I was actually in my first year dorm at university, just opened a booster box. It was on my MacBook, so half the screen was just the trackpad and the keyboard that you could see.
The lower mistake threshold of a top player, do you think that's a big factor when it comes to these big tournaments?
I think that's the biggest differential between sort of newer players or less experienced players and the ones who have been around the block for many years.
You valued your collection. I'm just going to ask you straight up, how much do you think your collection is worth?
It's definitely six figures. I mean, but if there's a chance, if there's a lucky dip, I'm looking at that pack up there even.
Yeah,
I want to see what's in there. I want to have that rush, that buzz of getting a good pack every now and then.
What was it you said? You said there might be a Charizard in there.
That's the first thing I said, right? So...
make sure to follow for future episodes and let us know who you want to hear from next. I hope you enjoy the conversation as we get to know Joe beyond the game. Joe, you are a Pokemon trading card game expert, but you do all sorts of different things. You're a competitor, you're a caster or commentator, you're a content creator, and you're also a collector. So very I told good. You the four C's of Pokemon trading card game. I want to find out your journey to where you got to here, but of those four things, what would you consider be your primary of those areas?
Competitor would probably be my primary. Mm-hmm. It's what got me into content creating, what got me into casting or commentary. And the collecting is something that is just a nostalgia piece, and it's something that you can sort of dip in and out of. I've basically been a snail's pace in collecting. This whole time, but it's, you know, you just appreciate the artworks, appreciate the cards, have memories for a lot of the older stuff. But that's much more in the background, whereas competition is my main focus in everything that I do. You know, for commentary, you still need to be completely on the pulse, on the ball. Same thing for, casting and all that good stuff. And that's what my channel is based all around as well, the competitive aspect of the TCG. So that would be what I consider myself most. First and foremost.
Yeah, so you do all things Pokemon trading card game, and you must have started loving Pokemon from quite a young age, as a lot of us did.
Yeah.
I was one of those people, as long as I can remember, I've loved Pokemon. You know, the first game I remember playing was Pokemon Blue. For you, what was your journey with Pokemon like growing up?
Very similar. Pokemon Yellow, I think, was the first one. Oof. I started with.
How old are you?
So I'm 28.
Oh, so I must have been a little young boy playing Blue then, because I'm 27.
I think my brother had Blue. He's 18 months older than me, and then I got the next one along. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was, you know, definitely the first handheld game I played. Fantastic game, obviously, carried on through all the generations, still play today, play on the Switch and whatnot. And it was definitely that sort of playground story of trading, collecting with friends, not knowing a thing about the rules back then, obviously, just sort of looking at hit points, looking at damage on cards and just saying mine wins, basically, was more or less what it came down
like a top trump of Pokemon.
Yeah. And it was just a phase for me as well. It was, you know, phased in and out of the playground when essentially it was when you were confiscated your cards from school and couldn't bring them in anymore. That pretty much is how that died. And then we moved on to, you know, Yu-Gi-Oh! And the next fad here, there and everywhere. But it was just that fad thing for me as well. I didn't have like a amazing affinity towards Pokemon, but came back to it when I was about 14. I actually had pneumonia when I was 14 years old. Oh, wow. So I was bedbound for about a month and I could basically just play Pokemon. And that was my escape, really. That was really all I had. And that's what brought me back into the cards as well. Randomly picked up a pack, pulled a card. It was an Uxie Level X back in the day. This was Legend Awakened booster packs in 2009, 2008, probably. And because I'd never seen a Level X card, I didn't know what on earth was going on. So I went and did some research, and it turned out that that was just a very competitive card, one of the best cards actually in the game at the time. So just by Google searching Uxie Level X, which was just by pure chance, it led me towards article sites and all this other stuff and the competitive side of the game that I've never seen before. So that's how that rabbit hole really started.
Yeah, I mean, 99% of the Pokemon trading card game world don't really think about the competitive side, which right. is, to me, always blew my mind because from the start, I saw the game as a game. Mm-hmm. I did do a similar thing to you of like, oh, hit points, power level. But quite early on, I got involved in, you know, the original PC game of it.
Sure.
With the kind of American girl who'd be like, hey, welcome. And it was like that whole game started me off with playing the game, and I understood the game, tried teaching family members, no one really learned it. And yeah. So then I just fell out of love with it. But it was always there in the back of my mind that I wanted to come back to it. So you grew up and you said at 14, unfortunately, you had pneumonia. How do you know what caused that? Because that's quite rare in a young yeah. person.
Well, I'm already asthmatic. So I guess I was more sort of high risk, I guess you would say. But it was actually because my parents moved house. And we moved into this really like old fixer-upper stately home thing. So it was because we were doing lots of building work and there was just loads of dust in this house that I got from it. So yeah, just a awkward situation. Thankfully, completely fine now. Mm-hmm. Much less severe asthma as I've grown up. Just one of those things. Yeah. And it's one of the ways that actually got me back into Pokemon, which is a strange silver lining. But I just remember playing Pokemon Diamond and Pearl on the DS, basically, when I couldn't go to school.
Yeah, and so you're around 14 here and you started to find out about the competitive scene. What were the next steps for you to start getting involved in the trading card game world?
Unfortunately, there wasn't a lot near me in terms of leagues or anything that nearby. And I was quite, you know, active as a young teen and whatnot. I played football, I did karate and stuff like that on the weekends. So it was really just playing online on Skype more than anything else. And that's where I met Jack. We actually entered an online tournament together where you would play with webcams on with the real cards. And that's where we met each other. And we were one of the only two people in the UK at the time. So we kind of just bonded over that. And basically, I would just play against him for probably, I would say, about 2 years before I even went to any actual tournament. So I was actually fairly reasonable as a player when I actually started going to tournaments. I remember the first city championships I went to, I ended up winning and actually faced Jack in the final of this tournament, only like a 40 player or so thing. But as soon as I got that win, I was like, hey, I'm actually reasonable at this game, even though I've only just started and whatnot. So getting that buzz of winning, even though it is just a small tournament, it was my first sort of exposure to it. It just naturally led me down further and further. You know, you get that little bit of adrenaline rush and see that you can do well in the game. It was like, well, I'm pretty much hooked from then on.
Yeah, so Jack, you mentioned there, your other half in Omnipoke, not your yes. not your other half in
no, relationship. Not in real life.
But you both run a channel together, Omnipoke, which for me was one of my main learning tools when getting good at the game at the start. You know, you do deck profiling, you analyze new sets, and you give people ideas on what they should look out for. You also look at past and future tournaments and give insight into what to expect there. How has that content evolved from the start to where you are now? Because obviously now you're one of the most respected voices in the scene. You know, you've commentated, competed, and all that stuff. So you the things you say, people listen and go, oh, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But at the start, I assume you had to build it up from somewhere. So what did the content look like at the beginning?
Well, the very first thing we did was a box opening. Mm-hmm. I was actually in my first year dorm at university, just opened a booster box. It was on my MacBook, so half the screen was just the trackpad and the keyboard that you could see. YouTube's come a long way. And it was very sporadic content. But really, this whole time, it's just been our progression, you know, the channel is definitely showing that how me and Jack have got further and further into the deep end of the competitive scene. And I think obviously the transition to, I guess, what you would call the modern era or the cash era of the Pokemon TCG, where they completely revamped the prizing structure and also national tournaments went away. They became these international tournaments, tried to really change the whole season really for Pokemon players. That was when we sort of turned much more into that competitive deep end. We were, you know, sort of casual competitive, I guess you could say, where we would, you know, attend nationals and have enough, you know, regionals in the UK and whatnot and cups that we would go to then being like, right, we want to do this most weekends, traveling up and down the country for cups, challenges, trying to get towards paid invites to world championships and stuff like that. That's when we sort of transitioned, I would say around 16, 17, when we got much more into the daily content grind, I guess you could say. That was the real turning point.
Yeah, so you mentioned about traveling around the country. We actually met the first time when I lived back up in Sheffield when I was there for uni. I played at the local up in Sheffield and we had a cup, which is about a 50-person tournament. And it's similar to the bigger tournaments in the structure, but more so, you know, easier access to people because it's local, less points on the line. Prizes tend to just be packs, that kind of thing. You traveled all around the country every weekend to try and attend these because those points add up over time. Mm-hmm. You know, with those cups, did you sort of sense a community forming within the UK as they started to happen more? Because you mentioned this new era of a modern structure and that community now, how different is it now in Pokemon compared to back when you first started, when you were doing Skype tournaments?
Right. Yeah. So back in that sort of 15, 16 sort of time period, it was honestly, you would go to this hall somewhere, a town hall or something like that, and it would be the same 30 or 50 people in a room, you're just in a different area of the country. So almost always, apart from around, you know, 20 or so who were just local like you were, it would be this little core group going north, south, east, west, and basically playing each other every week. And so it was really interesting in terms of a gaming perspective, because you could pretty much identify what people were going to play. And Pokemon is definitely a game where you can try and counter and come up with other strategies just to beat specific archetypes in the game as it evolves. So yeah, it was a really interesting time. I've made some of my best friends that I'm still friends with today during those years, where, you know, it's the first couple of years where I could start driving and whatnot, and it meant that I was going to these tournaments every weekend, crashing on someone's sofa, you know, preparing that night and then going in the morning together anywhere in the UK just for a smidgen of points and some packs. Very wholesome, but it's just for pure love of the game. And I think these days, you know, there are larger scale tournaments, so it's definitely a different feel. Where you probably need to put a good amount, a few weeks of preparation in. There's pressure on yourselves to do well, just because of how difficult it is to get an invite, even this season, for example. And, you know, it's a really big prize this year to go to Japan, where it's never been before, for the World Championships in August. So it's definitely a different vibe. Previously, we could just have fun, do whatever we wanted, really. And if you were just capable at the game, you could still have a good day. If you just run into good matchups or whatnot, have good fortune. And that's just completely different in these large-scale tournaments where now there's 800-900 people. You need to be extremely lucky as well as being very good to have a very high placement these days.
Yeah, so we've spoken about the local tournaments. Unfortunately, they stopped during the COVID period, and they're starting to come back soon, is what we've been told.
Yeah.
So now what we're focused on is these big events that you mentioned. They're really hard to do well in because there's so many people there. You know, we're talking 700 to 1,000. And even in North America, it's going above 1,000 now. Tournaments, people, we mentioned about the regulars you see on the locals, we're now talking about regulars across Europe, the same 500 people from all of Europe traveling to these different cities across Europe, and some people even from other regions flying in. So the professionalization of Pokemon has sort of happened, and it's a slow growth now in the sense the numbers are going up, so therefore prizes are going up, therefore the opportunities to succeed are going up, but yet still the community is very much a part-time professional, semi-pro, or hobby that pays a little bit, or maybe even for some people, they're paying to enjoy their hobby to be able to travel around the world. So this is very different to a lot of the guests I have in this podcast. You know, this is a podcast about people who've made a career in gaming a lot of the time, but there will be some guests like yourself where you partake in a community which doesn't have the income structure to be able to make it your full-time job. What I want to hear from you is what does that look like for you and the community in terms of income and how you can start to manage your life around a semi-professional hobby that can make a bit of money?
Yeah, a really great question. It's actually really tough trying to balance both. Honestly, for myself, it means that I've kept two jobs that I can keep, you know, clock in, clock out sort of thing. Don't have to bring stuff home, don't have stresses of other things, because my focus will be the Pokemon trading card game as soon as I get home. Mm-hmm. And that is where I will commit most of my evenings and nights, just either playing Pokemon or talking about the game or anything like that. And for me, I've tried to make content creation a way for me to afford all this travel. Mm-hmm. I basically started, well, myself and Jack started the channel together, hoping in the ideal sense it could allow us to travel places, and that could be part of the income. And that's definitely been helpful, especially with commentating. It's allowed me to go to all sorts of places across the globe for Pokemon to talk about the game, where I never would have thought I would have been. Australia, Latin America, some fantastic places. In terms of weekends and stuff like that, it's a real big cash sink. You're basically throwing away your money, right, to play in these tournaments, not just actual registration, but you have to pretty much, you know, front up hotel, flights a lot of the time. Obviously in the UK, we're flying everywhere, basically. And you have to go to, well, in Europe, you probably have to go to probably, I would say, 6 or 7 would be the minimum for this season to try and have a realistic chance to go to Japan. It's much harder, you know, this season because there aren't cups. And typically, you could probably get away with going to just 3 or 4 in a year, larger scale tournaments. But at the moment, that's just not the case. So you're having to put a lot of time in to these larger scale tournaments. And of course, because you're putting so much money on the line, you also need to commit that much more time to actually make it worth your while. Because if you're just going to spend £300-400 getting somewhere and staying somewhere, you may as well try and get into that sort of top 16, top 32. And unfortunately, the Pokemon pricing structure hasn't changed for a number of years now. I know the community are quite hot on that topic right now, and it does make a lot of sense that everything's getting more expensive and we have to go to so many of these, but the pricing structure hasn't changed. I think it wouldn't be surprising to me if it did change soon. But at the same time, these tournaments are filling up larger than ever and filling up literally within minutes. Mm-hmm. So there's no actual reason for them to look at the data and say, well, no one's happy here. Mm. From their data, everyone's extremely happy and can't wait. They're clambering to get into the door. Mm. So it shows just how good of a community and a game that it is. And you can still take these tournaments as a way to get away for a weekend, and you still see the city sometimes and can commit time to that. So there's more than just the tournament itself. But yeah, it's a bit of a difficult struggle, I would say. But it's just, you know, what our hobby is, and we just sort of take it on face value. I've been here when there was basically no prizing. I'll continue mm-hmm. to be here if it changes, no matter what, just because I want the opportunity to play the tournaments.
Yeah, because I guess the big thing is, even though you're going along to compete, which, you know, in an esports sense is the make or break, that's where you make your money or whatever, a lot of people still go along to these tournaments to compete knowing they're probably not going to win that many games.
Right.
You know, especially for people like yourself, you know, you come across people in the early rounds who are just excited to play against someone like you or play against another big name in the tournament. Mm-hmm. And they go along for the side events that go on. And
right.
and as you mentioned, these events sell out almost instantly. And that's 800 people choosing to buy a ticket to go to an event, booking hotels, booking travel. You mentioned about how many events per year. You said around 7 would probably be enough to convince yourself that you've given your best chance to make a world's invite.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about the structure, because, you know, in esports sense, there's all sorts of different structures, but I love the structure within the trading card game scene, because I think it's much more scalable when it comes to people who are doing it as a job and people who are doing it for hobby. You can kind of intermingle those two people, because there are a few players who are able to do this full time. You know, you look yep. at like Tord, for example, because he's so successful and consistent enough, he does make some money out of it. He can start getting sponsorships. He can make content and mm-hmm. people enjoy it. So there is a potential for that scale up to happen. So you've got these events that happen with points on the line, prize money on the line. You've then got big international events. I didn't realize before I came in that there's a way to earn travel reward, which
yeah.
is not a prize money per se, but it's prize money that you must dedicate towards traveling to a big event, right?
Yeah. So either Pokemon will sort out your flights and hotel for you, or you can choose to take a stipend and then you sort out your own accommodation and travel, which most people choose to do on average. Mm-hmm. Depends how it works out. Definitely if you're getting a travel award for your own region, like if you were to get a European travel award, you would definitely take the money, right? Because it's so easy for you to sort out your own accommodation and whatnot. But yeah, it's a really great incentive. It does mean that the top players in the game and those who are willing to travel as much as possible and really dedicate the time, they can get into that snowball, and then they start accumulating massive amounts of championship points, because the international tournaments, they're of course the most difficult throughout the year, but also they have very generous point payouts and prizing payouts.
Mm.
So if you really want to do well in the Pokemon trading card game, you have to be attending the international championships. And surprisingly, Oceania and Latin America, they have lower amounts of players entering them than a lot of regional tournaments. And regional tournaments have far less payout, right? So it's a no-brainer if you want to maximize your chance of getting to the World Championships, getting a day two invite to the World Championships, which is, let's be honest, the real World Championships. You have to win a whole tournament just to be entered into the tournament, essentially. Mm-hmm. To actually get that day two invite, the internationals are so integral for the serious players.
And you said the snowball effect. So an international event that you get invited to through the travel stipend, for example, you then earn the points at that event to get the travel reward for the next event. So you can start like accumulating those points.
And if your season starts off well, you have massive incentive to keep going to everything because you'll get paid trips to, you know, all over the world. And that's going to be huge for you. And then you end up, if you've done well enough throughout the entire season, even getting a paid trip to the World Championships and that day two invitation, which is so important because it actually is the way that you win the tournament at the end of the day. The World Championship is quite different for Pokemon trading card game. It's two different events, essentially, where you can have different layers of an invite to the World Championships. It's the only tournament in the year where you have to be invited in the first place. But there'll be a number of people who enter day one of the tournament based on a certain threshold of championship points earned throughout the season. And then if you have, at the moment, as you have a maximum of two losses in that first day of competition, it can be 8 or 9 rounds typically, to then progress into the day two of the competition, where there will be around, I would say, the top 100 or 150 or so from all regions who have achieved championship points to be within that group, who start fresh. And you can play a new deck to this tournament. And again, you need to have an absurd record to make it deep into the World Championships. You can probably only afford one loss and one tie. And this is against the best players in the world, where, of course, variance comes much more into effect, I would say.
Yeah, because that's a lot to take in. Like, even for me, I'm still kind of learning the structure and how it all works. But like the bottom line is you play a lot of games.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, in a trading card game world, the best players still come out on top. You know, we mentioned, I mean, Tor just beforehand, people like yourself, you know, these top 30 players that you consistently see making top 32, top 16, top 8. And it's very hard for newer players to break through, even though in theory it's a card game. So they should, if they play it well, they should be able to get the variants. How much skill is there in Pokemon trading card game, which, you know, for the average person, they might just think, oh, I'm shuffling cards and drawing off the top. So, well, if I draw the right card, I win, right?
Yeah, it's definitely the question I get all the time from aunts, uncles. It's just top trumps, right? That's always the one that I hear. It's a really difficult thing to quantify. And the game can be in different... There are different levels of RNG that come into play in the Pokemon trading card game, in different eras of the game as well. Right now, I would say we're in quite a high variance area of the TCG because we have very fast games where they're probably only 4 or 5 turns a lot of the time. So it really is important to have good starts. So a lot of the deck building is sort of taken away from you because you just have to maximize copies of the good cards that get you into the game, into your deck, and everything else is secondary because of just how fast the game has become, essentially. So a lot of the skill that could go in before a tournament, you know, the testing that you put in and the decisions that go into the deck that you play, that's basically restricted at the moment to roughly like 6 cards, 10% of your deck, I would say, that you actually have sort of creative license over, because most of the time you just need to slot in the guaranteed cards that get you into the game in the first place, which is a shame. And I do think that coming into the new EX era with Scarlet and Violet is very promising, because we're going into a more one prize focused format, which typically means that there will be longer games, more turns in games. So it's much less of a, did I hit it or did I whiff it off the amount of cards I've dug into my deck that turn, because it's so punishing in the game right now, where we have cards that can give up half the game's worth of prize cards. That's the main way to win in the Pokemon trading card game. And if you just whiff something and don't hit off a certain amount of cards that you draw in a turn, you're just dead in the water. So that is a bit of a shame. But yeah, there's a lot that can go into strategizing before a tournament, before you've even sat down. And then there's a lot of in-game play where you're trying to navigate your own hands. A lot of it is statistics-based. You're trying to give yourself the best chance of doing an action in a turn, or you're trying to hedge between a couple options a lot of the time. So You may outline the best direction or the optimal turn for you, but also sort of hold yourself back on certain things just in case things don't go your way. So you still have a backup strategy on the same turn.
So yeah, risk management.
And risk management,
one,
yeah.
One of the big things I think not enough people were speaking about when I came in, and I sort of applied this from esports, where I've seen long tournament days really affect players in a high-paced game like Rocket League. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just playing a local tournament where it was five rounds of Swiss into a top cut, I was exhausted at the end of that. And mm-hmm. I made so many mistakes in the semi-final and final of that tournament compared to what I was making the first rounds. And at these big events, you know, you're not only in a very loud hall, you know, you're not your typical home environment. You know, there's not easy access to food and drinks. Mm-hmm. You know, you might not sleep as well because you've just traveled to a new country. Sure. In a hotel. Might have been all night testing the night before. And then you've also got to play all these tougher games, which get tougher as you go on. You've got to play 9 rounds of Swiss on the first day, another 5-6 rounds of Swiss the next day. Then you've got mm-hmm. the top 8 kind of thing. You know, does the fitness for competing in trading card game, like the mental stamina and the lower mistake threshold of a top player, do you think that's a big factor when it comes to these big tournaments?
I think that's the biggest differential between sort of newer players or less experienced players and the ones who have been around the block for many years. Just that stamina and that mental fortitude to not get frustrated by the luck that's just guaranteed in this game. You, mm-hmm. you can't get around it. You can do your best to limit the amount of times it will affect your deck or you throughout the day, but it's going to happen. So just trying to take things round by round, the old cliches that you've heard from the top players, it's absolutely the right thing to do. Try and navigate yourself out of bad or low win situations is always a thing. Also, time management is a massive skill in the TCG, especially at the moment with best of three 60 minutes or 50 minutes a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to get those games in, especially if you know your opponent is playing a deck that has a longer game strategy. You have to always incorporate that. So a lot of people can get so focused just on the cards and the actions that are happening in front of them and not thinking about the actual game theory of how do I maximize my points in this situation? Am I trying to play for a tie? And this can be 10 or 15 minutes into the round based on if you're up against a bad matchup or whatnot. How do I extend this game so that I can win a second game? Mm. And what's the most likely way that I can win that second game? Is it going to be a quick win or is it going to be trying to drag out this strange situation? So all of these things come into the game, even though you're also having to actually navigate your turns at the time and try and look at what your opponent's doing and the best way to win. So these factors all come into the game, and it's not something you can just learn by grinding games. It's mm-hmm. what you need, you know, the real tournament experience will be the difference. And that's why you'll see so many top players end up with ruthless records of a huge amount of wins and very few ties. And it's no surprise that happens. It's definitely a differential.
Yeah, I mean, it's mesmerizing to me that you can play 9 rounds of Pokemon in a day and win all of them, right? Because, mm-hmm. like you said, there is variance in it. So a lot of these top players are able to consistently play with the luck. But let's take a pause from talking about the competitive scene. I think it's hopefully quite interesting for people who sure. don't know much about the trading card game world. We'll get a little bit more back onto you know, some of the challenges with being in the trading card game world and talk a little bit about your collection as well and, okay. and commentary. But we'll take a moment to ask about your top 5 games of all time. So I ask every guest this. I'm excited for this one because I feel like we can have a good old chat about Pokemon. Actually, my last guest that I had on, he brought up a Pokemon game. He said Pokemon Shield was his favorite Pokemon game. I'm interested to hear which Pokemon games you'll be choosing because that one riled me up a little bit.
It's a bold choice. I don't think it's going to be my favorite one. I would say if I'm going to choose a Pokemon one, I'll just stick to one to have some variety in our top 5. Uh-huh. I guess I have to say Pokemon TCGO, I guess, just for the sheer amount of time I've put in.
So the trading card game online. So it's been out, what, 10 years now?
Yeah, over 10 years.
And it's the main place for testing, for your content, for, I mean, online tournaments now are a big part of the community. So I guess from a career point of view, that has...
It's been massive. And it's the pivoting point in content for everyone, not just myself. It's made it so easy, right? You just screen capture what you're doing. And previously, you had to have a friend and play with in person and have a setup like this, which not many people have, mm-hmm. right? So opens that gateway, really, mm-hmm. PTCGO. So massive for the community and everyone, really. Incredible. And it's really important for everyone involved. And PTCG Live, the successor, a lot of people are worried about that because... It's not looking up to scratch, which is a shame, but hopefully they can work that out. So PTGO, probably is my Pokemon rep in my top five.
I feel like you could go for another Pokemon game if you wanted.
I could, but there's a lot that I want to talk about.
I'm not trying to change your mind here. I just want to talk Pokemon, okay?
Yeah, okay.
No, go ahead,
Okay, so I would say Mario Kart 64 is the first game I think I've really interacted with ever, at least that I have memory of. Like I said, my brother is 18 months older than me, and this is a big part of my personality is that I'm extremely competitive, ruthlessly competitive, and unhealthily competitive, probably. And that's been nurtured and grown ever since then. And I vividly remember it was Christmas Day when my brother got an N64 and got Mario Kart, and we hooked it up that day, played it for hours, absolutely played it for hours. And, you know, we weren't a particularly high standard. We were only kids or whatnot, and we'll still be not a very high standard of playing Mario Kart, I guess, in the grand scheme of things. But for having bragging rights over your siblings and friends, that definitely kicked me off on that trajectory. Mm-hmm. So Mario Kart is one that I look back on really, really fondly.
Yeah, 64 is a good game. I've played I played the game a little bit. I think if you've come from the modern era of Mario Kart and gone back and played
you'll hate it. Yeah.
It's awful. But if that's the first one you played with, you probably thought this is incredible.
Yeah.
What an incredible game design. That was back when 2D was only really possible. And so to have a game that felt 3D despite the 2D pixelated artwork, yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah. I think the DS is probably a better game, to be honest. But 64 is the one that...
The Wii version is the one that tends to come out on top amongst a lot of people.
Wii's a lot of fun too,
because a lot of people have good memories of that, and the mechanics of the game were pretty good. But yeah, DS for me was similar. That was my favorite.
Yeah, I remember doing a lot of DS time trials and stuff that.
So. And also the challenges in that one were great. You know, all of the different smart... It kind of reminded... Do you ever play Smash Bros. Melee?
Mm-hmm.
And they had the 50 challenges that you could do. And it was just really creative use of a game that didn't have much scenarios in,
right,
but to use those. And then that was the same thing with Mario Kart DS. Mm-hmm. They managed to create scenarios that felt immersive and like you're in a real world rather than just a racing track with cars.
Yeah, go faster each time.
Yeah.
So definitely a nod to Mario Kart. It's a classic party game even to this day. People will whip out the Switch and whatnot and will still play it.
Mm-hmm.
I would say one of my favorite things in a sort of a new genre of gaming was Dota Auto Chess. Bringing auto battlers to the table was massive for me. You'll already know, but many people know that I love drafting. And this is essentially drafting, but in a gaming sense, where you're building up essentially like an army to fight against someone else. And there's a lot of strategy based into that. And this was where I started getting into sort of like that Discord era for the first time. And we still have that Discord basically that we made so that we could play Dota Auto Chess among friends and whatnot. And that was also going into COVID, really. It was that sort of time period. And then we went on to Golf with Friends and Among Us and all that other stuff. So it all started with Dota Auto Chess. And so many auto battlers have come out since. I've spent a lot of time playing Battlegrounds on Hearthstone and stuff like that. So I would definitely say Dota Auto Chess was something that I really, really loved.
Yeah, I love that. So that's three there. You got PTCGO, the Mario Kart 64 and Dota Auto Chess. What are the last two then?
So I'll go for RuneScape, old school RuneScape.
Oh, wow.
I played as a young teenager, put a lot of time into RuneScape. Definitely a big part. Even at university, I got back into old school RuneScape, and just it's a time sink of a game. There's no way around it. So the amount of time I've put into that game alone probably just has to be in there. And they're still creating new content for it all the time. So that's definitely a fantastic one.
Did you have the paid membership or were you a free-to-play?
Of course I had paid membership.
Yeah. So I was a free-to-play. So my username came from my RuneScape account.
No way.
So that was the first game that I played under the name Gregan, which then became Gregan later on. But I was a free-to-play player, and I was only free-to-play because my parents wouldn't let me buy a membership. And I convinced myself that I would still have fun doing it, but every single day I'd zoom out, look at the map, and be like, there's so much to explore. I want to see the world.
Three cities.
An amazing game. I think it really set the tone for that sort of, what's it, massive multiplayer RPG,
MMO.
So that kind of game for you, I can imagine you min-maxed a lot. You'd find a way to, as efficiently as possible, get what you needed.
Yeah, I mean, I was similar to you where I was kind of just running around doing newbie things when I was a teenager and whatnot, and wasting a lot of time just wandering around doing stuff. But when I came back to it at university, that's when I'm like looking at all the guides and optimizing your way to play and spent and, you know, grinding and whatnot. But yeah, it's still a huge time sink. A lot of the time you're just there woodcutting or fishing or whatever. I don't know why I'm still doing this, but you get a little pop up in about 3 hours' time. So brilliant. Yeah.
And then number five.
And the last one will be Dragon Quest, another JRPG that isn't Pokemon. Mm-hmm. Really do love Dragon Quest. And I guess if I had to choose one, I would say Dragon Quest IX would be the one that I look to. Just for great replayability, great story, and just a real wholesome game, I think.
Well, the thing I see connecting a lot of those, except for Mario Kart 64, I think that one's more of a nostalgia one, but you love the numbers that make up games, right? Mm-hmm. So you see you probably do the research into what the back end numbers look like. You min-max things, you try and optimize things. Is numbers and maths the way your brain really thinks?
Sort of. I mean, I'm a bookkeeper at work. that is my job. So yeah, definitely mathematical and also very obsessive. When I get into something, I go all into something. So mm-hmm. really do like to put time into things. Obviously, I played the FIFAs, the Call of Duties, that sort of thing. Great time. And love playing online. Definitely an experience back in the day. But to really sink your teeth into something is something that I really enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, I can see a lot of similarities there with me. I did a talk in my sixth form at school. We had to do a talk to our form group. My talk was the maths of Pokemon.
Oh, yes.
Where I went through all the formulas Huge. And explained how they all worked. But anyway, enough about your top five. I want to find out what is your single greatest gaming achievement ever. And typically people relate this to their career. You know, it'll be something they've done career-wise. It could be just an in-game achievement, but I'm interested to know where you go with this.
For me, it's not really difficult. I would say commentating the World Championships in London was massive. It was always a pipe dream for me. The World Championships was always in the US. They always picked US casters. So I never thought I had a chance. I'd been commentating for years and never even had a look in. So when it came to London, when they announced it even in 2019, I couldn't believe it. I thought now there's a small smidgen of hope that it could happen. Then COVID comes, it's shut down for 2 years where I have to wait to actually see if I even have the chance to commentate at the World Championships. Eventually, I was chosen, which is just an incredible experience and really am so fortunate to be able to do it. And to commentate the finals of the World Championships with a teammate, with a deck that I helped construct, winning the entire tournament. Just like, it ticks so many boxes. And it was fantastic to do.
Yeah, I was there. I got to see it. And what a stage as well. Like, the whole event was incredible.
Oh, yeah.
And seeing you and Wossy commentating that final. You know, I've mentioned it to you before. When I wanted to get into commentating Pokemon Trading Card Game, in my mind, I was like, I would love to be Joe's co-caster because... to me, just talking to you and asking you questions about Pokemon, I feel like there is no question related to the TCG I could ask you which you wouldn't be able to give me some kind of answer to. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't know the full answer, I'm sure you'd go away and want to find out because that's the way your brain works around this game. So watching you in that final setting, I feel like you always answer the question or see something that we haven't seen before well before it happens. And actually, I've spoken to you a little bit about my Carsey and things I can work on and the things you'd recommend.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, though, you're competing. So you're not committing to the commentary route. And we mentioned about how this isn't a fully professionalized scene. It's very tricky to go fully professional in it. If there was a world where they could say to you, for this full year, we guarantee here's some income, here's a chance for you to commentate all the ICs, all the European events, go to Worlds, would you take that and give up competing?
In a heartbeat, I would, yeah. It's just, unfortunately, communication isn't the strong suit of Pokemon. And you basically just get an email fly into you when they want you for a tournament. But there's, you know, it's all single contract based. There's no obligation for them to choose you again, ever. I've been fortunate enough to do a number of the international tournaments, but I never expect myself to be there. But it means I can't plan anything. And it means that looking at the Japan World Championships, I'm playing right now so that I have that backup plan of if I'm not chosen to commentate, I'm still in Japan so I can play. So mm-hmm. I'm still trying to get that invite right now. That's why I'm not commentating. If I was given my year plan and I knew every tournament that I was going to and there was enough European tournaments that I could commentate, then I would do it immediately. Even though I am ruthlessly competitive and want to still achieve more things in the card game, I would definitely do that. And I'm happy just playing the game on that casual level once again.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough decision. I'm in a similar position with Rocket League of like, I want to commentate, but I also want to coach. And I want to commentate, I want to coach. It's always grass, always greener on the side you're not on. But for you, I feel like commentary it's such an amazing position to be at events because of the fact that you can still play, you can still go to events and do cubes and stuff like that. So I can see why it would be very enjoyable for you in the TCG, and hopefully one day that can be something that happens.
I would love it. And I could still get a taste of competition with cups and smaller tournaments like that. It's not the same, obviously, but you can still scratch that itch, I think.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. So we'll go back to a little bit around what it's like to be in the TCG community. So we mentioned before about the challenges of balancing it with work and the balancing of, you know, you go home, you do your content, and then you go to a tournament. You also mentioned with these big events that it takes quite a lot of preparation for them. Talk to me about what preparation looks like for you as a competitor. Let's just say for the upcoming Liverpool tournament's happening. You don't need to reveal any secrets about what you're doing, but we've got a tournament coming up. I think when this goes out, it'll have already happened. So hopefully you've done well. But for that event, you have a team that you prep with. What does that preparation look like?
A lot of the time we'll look at previous tournament results. Most top players will be looking at the previous tournament results to see what was successful, to see if there's any adaptations to decks, because there's a lot of variety that can go into even the same archetype, the same style of deck. And just adding in one or two cards in Pokemon actually can drastically impact matchups. So it's really important to know what to expect going into a tournament. You can even break it down to how many times in a day or over the 2 days I'd expect to see a deck. For example, Lugia, one of the most popular decks in the game right now, you'd expect to probably hit it maybe 2 to 3 times day one, could even be more than that. So you at the very least have to not have a bad matchup into one of the top decks in the room. You'd also have game plans for sort of the next best 3 or 4 decks in the game. There are times when the format can be very wide, very open, and you have to have strategies for maybe 10 or so decks. But I think the format that we're in right now, you probably need game plans for, I would say, around 5 decks, and then everything else you would be unfortunate to face once or twice in a day. And you're allowed to lose 2 games in the first day of competition in a regional championships, and you're allowed to tie 1 to still progress into the next day of competition. So you have to try and just focus on what you think is going to be most popular first and foremost. And then you have to decide the best target if you want to try and win against one deck really hard. If you think it's going to be popular enough to just focus on winning that one matchup, you can gear your deck towards having tech cards or just an inherently strong strategy into one deck, be it weakness or trying to prey on one of their core mechanics of their deck. You can try and go down that route. You can try and just not lose to any of the top decks as well. That's another strategy.
You talk about all this stuff, and like, I mean, you could just put it on a feel basis, right? You could be like, this feels like this should win here. But you guys put a lot of numbers behind it, right? You go through spreadsheets, you track training and practice. So what kind of numbers are we talking here? Like hundreds of games, thousands of games?
Probably not thousands of games. I would say a lot of it is theory-based, unfortunately, because there are online tournaments going on. You can look at that data to give you a real good insight into how matchups play out a lot of the time. And then you can really just play into the top decks more often than not. And that's when you will be grinding 20, 30 games into one matchup, see what can change. And as you make tweaks, how the matchup feels and whatnot. But ultimately, I've played enough games of Pokemon now that I know what game plans you want to go in with. And you know how certain cards will change things. And even if you're giving yourself small percentage points by adding an extra copy of a card to see it, you know, 3 or 4% more throughout the game or whatever, or more quickly. In certain instances, there are cards that can only be impactful if you find it on a certain turn. You can just take that in your stride. But also there are tons of other things out there to bear in mind. A lot of the time when you're adding in tech cards, you're taking away consistency cards. And like I alluded to earlier, you want to simplify your deck as much as possible. It's always been my sort of catchphrase, I guess, just simplify, dumb down everything so that you're just doing your thing and imposing your strategy on opponents more often than not. Because if you're playing one of the top 3 or 4 strategies in the game, just doing it 9 times out of 10 beats a lot of other things just in general.
Yeah, so we've talked a lot about the competitive side of things. And I think just from hearing you speak about it, I think a lot of people realize it's a lot deeper than they might realize. If someone right now was listening to you talk and they thought, oh my goodness, this all sounds quite overwhelming. What would you recommend a starting player right now? Say someone listening who's, you know, opened a few packs, maybe some booster boxes, maybe bought some of the pre-made decks or whatever it is, and they're thinking, actually, Joe, I'd like to give this a bit of a go. It sounds like a lot of fun. What would you recommend for a starting player right now?
I would start by looking at you can honestly just go onto YouTube and type in like top 10 decks or something like that, and then put the month of the year or something and see what's recent and look at any of those decks. Ultimately, you just need to pick one of them and play it lots, essentially, is the main thing to do. As you play against different decks, you'll figure out what they're trying to do against you and how they're trying to play the game, and you'll realize that you can change what you're trying to do, your deck. In Pokemon, a lot of the time, your deck's trying to do the same thing over and over again, but you will make changes in what you're trying to do, in what order, especially, based on what you're up against. So see why you're losing, see why you're winning, and sort of take that on stride. I think the newer you are, the more games you need to play. You need to experience things. You need to feel it for yourself. So pick one of the better decks in the game right now.
How would you choose a deck? So like when I first started, I had a feeling that I wanted to play Welder-based decks back when that was a thing. Sure. So I could just read that text and went, this is broken. And I wanted to play that. And it was one of the top decks at the time. And then I stuck to it and I understood that game mm-hmm. method. And then it made me realize down the line that I quite like box decks, ones where you've got lots of one-offs in a deck sure. and then you pick and choose them. So now I like the Inteleon line. This is a whole load of gibberish for anyone who doesn't know Pokemon. So I like Inteleon decks because you've got a box deck of trainers, essentially. Uh-huh. So I realized I like that over draw because I get very frustrated when I draw three cards off the top and it's not the cards I need, even though that is a very viable way to play the game in Pokemon. Yeah. So if you're a newer player, do you suggest just picking a deck at random, or maybe if you like a certain type or whatever it is, how would you choose?
That's why I suggest like a top 10. I think some things will stand out. Like you said, Welder stood out to you. And if you're coming from other card game backgrounds, there'll be things that you can, that will catch your eye and immediately you'll start looking at. But it would be good to jump around a couple of decks just to play 5-10 games or so. If one sticks, then just dedicate more time to that. If you're jumping straight into the deep end and want to actually do well at a regional, you probably need to play that same deck a lot and mm-hmm. over a number of tournaments to start seeing any kind of success with it. That's why I sort of suggest just stick to one and hang on to it.
You mentioned PTCGO, Pokemon Trading Card Game Online. So you say go and play online with it.
Definitely.
And then another thing would be theme decks as well. Just start off, like, get used to the game. Like,
that's the core mechanics of the game.
Yeah, get used to the core mechanics.
Yeah, definitely. That's how you learn the rules of the trading card game. I wouldn't spend too much time on theme deck format because it's actually quite different to real life Pokemon.
It is,
because
yeah.
Pokemon in real tournaments, you get to access so much of your deck, and it's so different to theme deck format where you're happy to see a draw three mm-hmm. style card, which would just never be played in standard format. So you actually get to access your deck constantly in standard format. So you're making a lot more of the decisions, whereas a theme deck is making it a lot of decisions for you because you mm-hmm. can only play one or two things from your hand and you don't have much else to do. Mm-hmm. Certainly learn the core mechanics of the game through a theme deck, or league battle decks, I think, are a better step up. Some of the more recent products that Pokemon have come out with, that's a closer to standard style experience where you're still learning. Those would be the things that I would suggest. But yeah, grinding lots of games essentially would be it.
Yeah, so a league battle deck, they're brilliant for starters. You know, it's got all the cards in it you need. In fact, as an experienced player, I know a lot of people just buy the league battle decks anyway, just yep. because they've got so many of the cards they need for a good value.
For sure.
So league battle decks, you're then thinking, do you know what? This online thing's not quite getting my fancy. I want to play in person. What's the step there to try and get in person? Because flying to, like, obviously Liverpool's close to us, but like flying to Warsaw, which was a recent regional, mm-hmm. quite a commitment for a newer player.
Yeah, there are still leagues, even though that you can't earn championship points. There are still plenty of grassroots tournaments that go on, and just for fun most of the time, or just for a handful of booster packs, even though there aren't championship points on the line. There are plenty of card game stores around. Almost all of them do Pokemon. Mm-hmm. So going there midweek, going there on a weekend, that's how you start integrating yourself and getting a taste of playing up against other people. And naturally, you'll meet people who are probably deeper into the community than you if you're there for the first time or whatnot. Or you can meet new people together and start learning together as well. And mm-hmm. obviously sort of joining that hive mind, getting integrated into the community is going to be more fun for you than just sort of doing it on your own. But also you'll start harvesting information from other people who have been there and done that with other decks or have other card game experience and can make you start thinking about the game in different ways that you haven't quite yet.
Yeah, so the competitive scene is, you know, there's so many places across the country. When I moved here to London, first thing I did was look up what's the nearest shop, and it turned out it was quite close and it's one of the best in the UK, so I was very lucky with that. But for some people like yourself, you're in the middle of nowhere, so you don't have that walk to store that you
certainly
can,
not walk to. No. I think I'm about 30 or 40 minutes away from the nearest place to.
Yeah, so it's not always easy, but yeah, have a little look for that. And if not, siblings are a great opponent sometimes. Yeah,
try and just force anyone you can to learn the rules with you.
Yeah. Yeah, there's quite a few kids who play with their parents as well, and then they go along as a duo to a tournament where the parent plays, gets knocked out early, and then they support their kid through the tournament. But enough about competitive side. I think a lot of people who will be listening will know about collecting Pokemon cards and will be very aware, especially with the recent boom with the whole Logan Paul stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, you've done some content with Randolph as well, who's one of the UK biggest content creators around collecting cards. Mm-hmm. You yourself have quite a lot of Pokemon that you've collected, and they're all graded up. And you know, you as a person love the numbers, and I like to think you valued your collection. I'm just going to ask you straight up, how much do you think your collection is worth?
It's definitely six figures.
Six figures.
I mean, yeah. I don't want to give a real number, but I have to insure it for a lot. it's costing me money to keep it. But yeah, I mean, this is a project I've had for, yeah, again, 14 years.
And you've been collecting before the big boom, so the value has shot up since.
So I literally have opened packs that are worth more opened now when I bought them when they were full. The contents of the cards were all still there for empty booster packs of the cards and boxes and stuff like that. So
the actual, like, the packaging of the packet is worth more now than the sealed product with the cards in it was when
correct.
You bought them.
Yeah.
So how long
boxes that I was opening that cost like £100-200 or so are now in the 15,000-16,000 range. So I was very lucky of when I got back into collecting.
So when did you start collecting?
This is probably still around 2008 2009,
and you were focused around Wizard of the Coast cards, the original ones.
Yeah,
so you've got a lot of the original, like, do you just talk through the collection that you got? What kind of things you've done a YouTube video where you've gone through your collection?
Sure.
I've looked at a lot of it myself. Is that the original base sets and so on, and what specifically were you collecting?
The entire Wizards of the Coast era is sort of my main graded collection, I guess you could say, where I'm trying to get one of each holographic in mint condition or better.
So that's is that nine? Is
that PSA 9.
PSA 9.
And 10s. Uh-huh. I would buy 10s if they were cheap enough, or if I sent in cards myself and they received a 10, I would keep them. Mm-hmm. So I've got a mixed 9-10 sets between base set Shadowless all the way up to Skyridge. It's very close to complete now, actually, as well. So
and it's probably getting harder as well, because things are getting more expensive.
Yeah, it's getting a lot harder. I have to really pick my moments to buy cards these days. But no, it's something I'm very proud of. And obviously my collection has all sorts of other things just from collecting over 14 years. I have a lot of Japanese cards as well. Have a lot of newer age cards as I've, you know, opened new stuff this entire time. Sold basically none of it. So I just have, you know, full arts of all and level X's and EX's from all these different eras this entire time. And I enjoy the grading aspect. Initially, it was because pictures on eBay were so bad that I couldn't tell the condition of a card. And if you would buy a card just to fill in a binder slot, and it was worse condition than something you open from a pack, you don't want it, right? It looks a lot worse. It stands out. So back then, that was when I liked graded cards. I could see, yeah, this is saying it's a mint condition card. That's why I'll get it. So I was into graded cards quite quickly as well. I would say within a couple of years, I was into grading when it was still very, very young, I guess, as within the Pokemon hobby at the very least, where not many people were doing it. So sent a lot of cards off via Ludkins, which is no longer a thing, but also graded Gem in the UK. Great sort of ways to send your cards. Been doing it again for many, many years, and it's really grown the collection.
Yeah, and you mentioned about how you've been in the competitive scene for a while and you still keep all your collection. So you have binders full of competitive cards from modern era. And you, hopefully later on after this, we'll get to play some old popular decks. But you also like to have decks built and cubes as well, which we'll talk about in a sec, of the old era cards from I want to say better eras or eras that you preferred.
Sure.
Where you would get, like, I assume you went for the world's decks. So the best world decks from the world championship.
Yep.
And you build those up and you have them all ready to play. You know, a lot of that stuff, it might not have the same value of the collection, but to you, what do you see as your favorite part of your collection?
I do really love the World Championship decks because they have that replayability aspect to them. You know, you're actually using the cards, kind of what they're intended for. And obviously, I'm a competitor as well. So a lot of the years I will hark back to of really enjoying certain decks or having played certain decks myself, even at the World Championships. So I do really like that aspect. But again, I've got binders as well, just flicking through binders, looking at different artwork. Fantastic to see.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I enjoy all aspects. That's why I have the different aspects. So the PSA cards are great to just sort of look through, sift through. And yeah, the World Championship cards are cool as well.
Yeah, and through a mutual friend of ours, Alex, who we'll be seeing a bit later on, he mentioned how organized you are with your stuff. So we mentioned you like your numbers, you're a bookkeeper, you know, you've always been very theoretical, logical with the way you describe things. I can only imagine what your collection looks like. It's very organized. Talk us a little bit about how you organize things and what your sort of collection looks like.
Pretty much my life is in spreadsheets in one way or another, and mm-hmm. the collection is no different, where I've got a number of tabs with cards, with their grade, their certification number, value I bought at, value that they are now, all this other stuff. I have to keep that just for insurance purposes of the value of the cards up to date as well. There's lots of different ways you can store your collection as well. The PSA website allows you to put in the certification numbers of all your PSA cards, so you can have a virtual collection showing there as well. And yeah, I've got lots of estimations of lots of other cards that are raw, still to be graded, all this other stuff. It is fairly organized, but there's still a lot that's sort of out of place. And I do have to, you know, get lost in the weeds looking for cards here and there still.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I spend a lot of time sifting through cards. That's mm-hmm. just how it is.
I don't know if this is too personal a question, but do you think there is something about the way your brain works that is particularly different because of the way you've acted around Pokemon and everything? Because that kind of level of organization and... I don't want to use the word OCD because I'm not trying to diagnose
it. Don't worry, you can use it.
Yeah, but like, have you ever explored that around the way your brain works and how it might be different to others?
Not particularly. I mean, at university I did psychology, so I am quite introspective and quite aware of some of my own habits and whatnot and the way that I think, I guess. But I've not really looked into the OCD side of it too much. I'm sure it does come into play with how it's helped me be a competitor. In some aspects help me with my collection and whatnot. But I just think keeping organized is pretty logical. It just seems to be a thing that you should be doing if you're looking after this stuff. And it's worked out pretty well.
Yeah, very logical man. And one day I'd love to see the collection in person.
You can come down.
I'd be interested. Because I mean, I've always loved the original Pokemon. I'm like the classic story. I had all the stuff and then gave it away. I've kept a few bits and bobs, but I didn't look after them well enough back in the day. If I were to sell my cards, yeah, it would be one of those grimy cards that you described, not in a PSA slab, probably less than 5 on most of my things. And probably some of them are fake, I'm going to be honest. I don't even know for sure. In fact, one of the cards for the collectors out there who might be aware of it, you know, the Lugia with the Elemental Blast? I can't remember which set's from the...
Neo Genesis.
I have one of those. It's completely battered up, but I know that that's a very expensive card if it's graded well.
Sure is.
And I just wish I had.
Yeah, I mean, Neo Genesis, it's expensive because it's one of the hardest sets to grade. That's why it's super expensive.
But so all those cards, I'm sure there's a lot of people at home who are looking back at their collections, wishing, especially over lockdown, everyone was going, "Mom, Dad, where did you put the cards?" And they're like, "Oh, we binned them because they're in the loft and taking up room." For you, you've collected them, you've graded them all. They're now all pretty and look nice in your set. What is your favorite part of your collection? If there was one card, if I had to say, single out one card that you love, maybe it's for a story or whatever, what would that card be?
It would probably be a PSA 10 Expedition Mew, I would say. Expedition is one of my favorite sets in general. I opened this set on my birthday. My 15th birthday, I opened it, and the e-reader sets were something that I had never collected as a kid. I was already sort of out of the phase by then, or phasing out, I guess you could say, so I didn't really have any e-reader cards, so just seeing that difference in border and how the cards looked, and the artworks of Expedition is just fantastic. The Expedition set is great because it has all the starters in there. It has Mew, it has Mewtwo, and then it also has the Gen 2 starters in there, so many great cards within that set. And it's just a fantastic artwork of a Mew, and it's a high grade, which always is nice. It was one of the first cards I sent off to get graded and encapsulated because I realized that these were sort of special. So Expedition, definitely one of my favorite sets. I've got it completed. And yeah, the Mew is one of the standout holographics. I did also have a Skarmory PSA 10, which there were only six in the world in that grade, but I have traded it away. In COVID, actually, someone reached out to me and we were able to bash out a deal for a lot of other cards. It was a trade rather than sale. So I got some good cards for that. And that was probably like the rarest card, the most difficult card to get in my collection. But I'm not so fussed about having a 9 versus a 10 too much. And this is purely condition rarity. The Skarmory itself isn't that rare. So I was quite easily able to get a PSA 9 version, knowing that this other person was completing their entire PSA 10 set, which is one of the only, I think there's only three people in the world who have a PSA 10 complete set of Expedition. So I was happy to help another very serious collector out in that goal. And I got a pretty good deal too.
Yeah, I mean, the whole collection scene is unbelievable now, especially with the eyes that have been on it.
Right.
You've been around for a while. You're very lucky to have increased that value. Do you ever intend on selling anything? You mentioned how you like to keep everything. So I do imagine you're sitting on a gold mine if you wanted to.
Right.
But I don't think that's really why you do it, is it?
Honestly, COVID was one of the most stressful times for me because I started having that dreadful feeling of actually thinking, these are at values that I may never see again, at least for another like 10 years or so. And the trajectory was completely miles away from what I expected these cards to actually be worth. And I had a real internal struggle with myself to be like, is it time to dump it all? Knowing that I still completely adore these cards.
I assume you could have bought a house off of just selling a lot of that collection.
I actually did buy a house in COVID, and I actually paid my deposit from selling some duplicate cards. So
oh,
that's
really?
Actually something that happened. Yeah. So my deposit was paid for by a couple of base set Charizards that I sold, duplicates. So yeah. But it was that point of, do I sell it all? Do I go crazy? Get rid of everything? Because I knew that it was absolute chaos and the cards didn't deserve that sort of value. I still think we're coming down. I think we're still deflating in the market. That's why I've not been buying many things. I still think it could go lower potentially for a lot of cards. Even it's only really high-end cards, like a difficult to grade rare old PSA 10s that I think are probably fairly accurately valued right now. I think a lot of them are still overinflated just by the influx of people who are interested. But maybe that's my skepticism and cynicism because I've seen them at such low prices for many years and many other people haven't had that sort of interaction and they value it in a different way to me. Because I understand that I am still in a bit of a minority situation. But yeah, I had many sleepless nights throughout COVID thinking about this collection. And even if I was to sell everything at a high price, then the effort and the work of me getting things back would take years to sort of reaccumulate the cards, even if I could get a good deal on them or, you know, make money from selling and rebuying and whatnot.
Yeah, because you could have sold at the boom and then rebought. Yeah,
and so I knew it was chaos. Yeah. I knew it was absolutely mad.
So you knew it was going to peak and then go down. So you very much could have just sat on that that mindset and rebought your collection back and just made profit. Yeah.
So I sold probably a tiny amount of cards and only duplicates, never selling things that I didn't already have or couldn't get back easily. So I definitely still look back at that and think that I could have financially made a great move just by selling everything. But I still feel way too attached to these cards. I'm a hoarder. I even keep empty booster packs of the cards, like I mentioned earlier. So yeah, it's a complete warehouse, my actual house full of cards. And I just can't bring myself to sell lots of things. It is probably on the horizon of, you know, probably in the next 10 years, I'll probably look to sell a lot of these things. But I'm still enjoying them. So I still want to keep them.
I guess the last question around your collection, do you own any sealed products?
That's the biggest mistake I think I've ever made. I've always enjoyed opening everything.
I've heard through a few of our mutual friends that you are one of the worst people when it comes to wanting to open packs. You'll rip stuff to shreds. If people don't tell you to not open something, you'll open it before they get a chance.
Yeah, I just love opening cards. I mean, it's one of the most fun parts about collecting and playing the trading card game. I think I literally only have things, I've only been able to keep things sealed that when I know what cards are in them. So like boxes of theme decks or world championship boxes I've got sealed. But if there's a chance if there's a lucky dip. I'm looking at that pack up there, even.
I want to see what's in there.
I want to have that rush, that buzz of getting a good pack every now and then.
What was it you said? You said there might be a Charizard in there.
That's the first thing I said, right? Yeah. So, yeah, I do love tearing into packs, and it's definitely a favorite pastime of mine.
Yeah, I guess the reason why I asked that is because one of the first things I got told when I first started getting back into Pokemon was through a friend of mine, Iblistic Squid, who was a Minecraft YouTuber back in the day. He bought two base set boxes just before the big boom. And he was like, well, these are the best things to have in a collector space because they're only ever going to go up in value because every single day there is a chance someone else will open one.
Right.
So the numbers go down. So all the while you've got one, you're guaranteed for it to be more rare.
Yeah, the direction's all down.
Yeah, and whereas the other side is true of cards will go up in numbers as things get opened, but equally the quality of those is unlikely to because even pack fresh is hard to get a 10, so that's why 10s are so rare.
Right.
The idea of getting a 10 of a 20-year-old card now is really tough.
Mm-hmm.
And so the interesting thing for me is those people who do collect sealed products and how they hold back from opening them.
Never been able to myself.
But I guess there is that is a very much the non-collector mindset. That's this is money I'm sitting on rather than this is a fun hobby that's got all these intricate cards.
Yeah. And trust me, my collection would be worth a lot more if I kept everything sealed.
Yeah.
No doubt about that. Even with good luck in getting lots of tens and nines and keeping everything, you know, as mint as possible. Instant sleeving everything, even back when I was 14 years old, top loading everything, not letting them see the light of day this entire time. Opening packs is a losing game almost always. Keeping things sealed, it's the smarter way to go, but it's not the way you appreciate the cards, you know? If you want to actually look at the cards, you got to open the packs.
So what, to you, does a Pokemon card mean to you? Like, if you look at a Pokemon card, what does it mean to you?
It depends. I mean, I'm looking at all aspects of it. I'm enjoying the artwork, but I'm also looking at how it could interact in various formats, the standard format, cube format, old format, all that good stuff. So sometimes I can have memories pertaining to the card, but it encapsulates a lot, to be honest.
So the graded cards you look at as art, I guess.
A lot, yeah.
And then you've got the newer ones where you look at the text and you try and sort of see the value of the text.
Right.
And then you said you also appreciate just the artwork of general cards. So when you're opening those packs from a big set, you're not just looking at the ones which you know are competitive, you're appreciating all of them.
Yeah, I would say so. Even modern era packs, there's still some fantastic artwork and new artists being introduced all the time with different styles. And they're doing a great job over the last few years of adding, you know, full art cards and the trainer gallery and whatnot. The new technology of what they can do with a card now is incredible. So there's a lot to like in modern collecting as well. And that's also something that I do. So,
yeah, you mentioned all different formats. So we'll briefly touch on that because you're a big fan of the cube format. And I got a chance to experience my first cube in Stuttgart. I was shocking, but that is expected.
It's not the worst I've seen.
You gave me a tough cube. So within Pokemon, you've got the standard format, which is the one which we've spoken about a lot of, the competitive one, people go to tournaments. There is expanded, which allows you to use cards that are rotated out of the standard format, and it can be quite a chaotic format, and one that a lot of people don't like because of how little is in your control if the other person goes first and stuff like that. But then we've also got these extra formats. So there's Gym Leader Challenge, which is created by Andrew Mahone, right?
Yeah.
Over in America. And then there's also the cube format, which is common across all trading card games, which is the idea that you have a box of cards that you you draft. And so you pass little piles of them around in a group and then you take one out each time and you make your deck out of that. Why is it that you love this format so much?
Firstly, for any cube, that pile of cards that you talked about, the person who's made that pile of cards has done it specifically to create a battle experience that is possibly their favorite way to enjoy the trading card game. So you have a lot of control over what cards are going to be drafted from and what can be used. So it then dictates how the gameplay is going to feel, right? So it can be drastically different to the standard format. They could try and throw in lots of draw power, lots of powerful attacks that are cheap and efficient to have a real quick back and forth. Or you can try and throw in lots of cards that have a really slow, grindy pace of play. So the person who's created a cube can make the game play feel between players however they want to.
can even theme it around the Pokemon themselves, right? You could do like a Gen 1 cube, or you could do a based off of the Sword and Shield era cube.
Exactly.
You can do it all sorts of different ways.
Yeah, so there's that element, but also the drafting part of the cube is also a massive part of the fun for me.
When we did our cube, I noticed there was this, right, I've drafted now. Oh, no, we have to play. we did the whole drafting process. Everyone had a great time. And then the moment we had this pile of cards, which we had to make a deck out of and play, everyone was like, right, I'm done now.
Yeah. So there's so much more strategy within that drafting element. That again, it's similar to almost like that preparation you put in before a tournament of the TCG. That aspect and that time and thought that you've put in throughout the draft will then influence how you do in the games a lot of the time. So there's just so much depth in drafting in general that you can sink your teeth into that adds to the fun before you even sit down and play the games. And I think it's always fun when you sort of battle your wits against someone else and see what they've come up with and where the draft took them in terms of what they've seen throughout the draft, which is obviously going to dictate what they end up playing, but also how they value cards against one another is something that changes within cubes, and for different players they'll value cards very differently. So the drafting element is just so addictive and so fun and so varied as well, because of the element and the nature of drafting, there will be things that combinations that come together that you may not have seen in the last 10 times that you've played this same draft. So it also has a lot of replayability.
Yeah, lovely. I mean, the limits of Pokemon are very, very few. You can do whatever you want with it. I think the standard format is definitely the place to go for beginners, but I still haven't sunk my teeth into GLC. I do watch a lot of videos around it, and I really enjoy watching it, but I just haven't got the cards to play it. I'd love to give it a go at some point. And like I alluded to earlier, we're going to have a chance now to play some old formats, so there's a lot of depth to it, and I appreciate you sharing all the information, experiences, and talking about your collection. I think collection for me was mind-blowing hearing some of the stuff there, and I guess a little bit of fortune around the timing, so... You know, there could be someone out there who's collected another card game and the card game died 2 years later and they got unlucky. Right. So, you know, very fortunate with that and appreciate all your experiences that you've shared. But to me, I've got to ask one final question to you, Joe, which is, what does gaming mean to you?
I've listened to your podcast a lot, so I've actually had to pre-think about this. I couldn't really think of anything too clever or ingenuitive, so I just thought time sync was probably what gaming is to me, because I go head first. When I enjoy a game, I will put all of my time into that game. So that's what it is to me.
Lovely. Well, thank you very much, Joe. And I'm excited for this Pokemon session tonight, but I'm sure everyone at home will be... We'll be doing their own little research into how they can get involved, and I'm sure I'll get you back on at some point.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.